pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Thank you, Scott, for that wonderful introduction again. And ladies and gentlemen, you're back with the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. Scott, how are you going this evening?
Look, you know, the news didn't get any worse, but unfortunately, I suppose it was too much to hope that we might have 2 weeks of great news, but at least there was nothing too disastrous. A couple of items came up during the week where it was a bit more of an investigative look at the current government and see what sort of influence the Godbotherers are actually having on them.
Right.
Yeah, so if...
That's the Saturday Paper article, is it?
Yeah, if there's no further ado, I'll jump straight in, shall I?
But, sure.
Listeners, there's a little publication called The Saturday Paper. It's not Murdoch or Fairfax, it's independent. And Mike Seckham was writing in this past Saturday, so August the 29th, and the title of the article is Prime Minister Tony Abbott and the Christian Right. It's quite a lengthy article, and it goes into an awful lot of detail about the influence that the church is having on the current crop of liberals. Liberal being a misnomer, obviously.
Mm.
It starts off with the Canning by-election, which is in a couple of weeks' time. The Liberals' pre-selected candidate, can't think what his given name is, but he's...
Andrew Hastie.
Andrew Hastie. Thank you very much, Fist. Hastie was speaking to the... where is it? Can't think what the name is. But anyway, the West Australian Liberal Party branch. And he identified himself as a regular churchgoer, spoke about the church work that he and his wife do in their church group, relayed a story about his father having started a church in country Victoria from scratch and how much fun he had working with his dad going through the vast parish down there. Then Seckham poses an exceptionally good question. In the very early in the article, he said, "There's nothing wrong with any of that, of course, but ask yourself this. How many job applicants in Australia would feel the need to stress their piety in the interview?" Damn good question.
Only those applying for the current cabinet, they would feel the need.
Exactly, and that is the point he then goes on, saying he's not applying for any job, he's applying for a job with this particular government. Mm. He went into, now a couple of weeks ago, Fist, you highlighted an article that said the number of practicing Catholics that were in the cabinet. Those numbers obviously haven't changed, but if you then... Seckham went through and did a lot more analysis on those people. You have, on the sort of moderate side of Catholicism, Malcolm Turnbull, right through to your extreme, the Defence Minister, Kevin Andrews, and everything in between. But there are a lot more of them on the devout side as opposed to the submarine Catholic variety.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, also in amongst the cabinet, from non-Catholics, from the Protestants, you've had, we mentioned before, Scott Morrison and his rather Hillsong style of Christianity, and Erica Betts is someone that I didn't realise was also a mad keen Christian, but he's from a mob called the Reformed Church of Australia, whose little mission statement is pray, multiply, a train, and a line. Yeah. And then, of course, then on the backbench, every family's favourite, Corey Bernardi. Going through the article, there's a hell of a lot of information that I sort of knew, but it's actually never been laid out in such a forensic way. But one of the great things that Seckham did point out was some work that was done by Paul Pickering back at the turn of the last century, 1998. He was an ANU professor. He had a biographical analysis for the 36 new conservatives who were elected in the Howard Landslide in 1996, and he compared it to the previous mass intake of conservative members in 1975. Key difference between all of that was the presence of God in their opening speeches. Their maiden speeches is the technical term for them.
Yep. And where God family values as well.
Family values was the very big thing, yes, which is basically code for God. But Pickering writes, he said, where God received one reference in 1975, The speeches in 1996 contain numerous reference to God and principle and Christian principles. He also noted that in 1996 we had a new emerging sort of, I'd call it Tea Party, you know, this sort of, he described it as, quote, the shrill chorus of anger. He cited discussions about minority groups, thought control, social engineering and political correctness. A little fun fact here, Tony Smith, who's just replaced Bronwyn Bishop as Speaker, he described the state as a great praying mantis.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting.
But it's that sort of Tea Party line of small government, you know, all mm-hmm. government is bad, you know, total free enterprise is the way to go, with a good lashing of the Bible thrown into the mix. It's very much that sort of flavour.
And exactly. Now, people that have left the Liberal Party, or sorry, maybe still members, are members of the Liberal Party, but they've certainly left Parliament, such as Judy Moylan, Cheney, I think it was, yeah. What was Cheney's given name?
I keep thinking of between him and his father. One was Fred, wasn't it?
One was Fred, was it? I didn't realise he had a father as well. Okay, well, anyway, Cheney, who was in the Parliament for 20-odd years and had been back since he was in there in 1975. He and Judy Moylan were asked different points. Moylan's, I thought, was far more interesting. She said here, these are Judy Moylan's words, "It was far more liberal when I came in, but as time went by, it came more and more dominated by right-wingers. It hadn't moved to where it is now, where it is starting to look like the American Tea Party."
Mm.
"I think, unfortunately, that the party will pay dearly for its extreme views in many quarters at the next election." I mean, yeah, clearly. It's obvious that a lot of the decisions that are being made by the cabinet are completely out of step with what the community wants. And it is that sort of giant lurch to the right. She's hit the nail right on the head. It has become a Tea Party with an Australian accent. But I thoroughly recommend that the listeners go and have a look at all this, because there's an awful lot in there. We even go back as far as he mentions Menzies. Menzies would probably not recognise the party he founded now, because in Menzies' days, generalising, but generally a Catholic went and voted with the Labor Party. They joined the Labor Party. There was the split with the DLP, obviously, over communists and so on and so forth, and social progressives versus social conservatives. But the big shift was, it was hard to actually pick what people's religious beliefs were, even in Menzies' day, when going to church was far more normal than what it is now. Whereas with this current crop, a lot of them wear it on their sleeve, or wear it as a badge of honour.
Yes, there was this Professor John Warhurst, who was doing research into 27 Australian prime ministers, and basically saying that it was really hard to establish mm-hmm. whether many of them had a religious belief, which you couldn't say about, you know, the last 20 years. So it just goes to show that this is not
10. Do you reckon?
Well, you know, Howard, so...
Yeah, but he was little more circumspect about it. Anyway, go on.
But, you know, it just goes to show that this is not the norm. It hasn't been the norm in Australia, this God bothering by our political leaders. And, you know, the point is, if you tried to research 27 Australian prime ministers of the past, a huge proportion of them, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to know what they were, because it didn't come up. So,
Well, they had this, you know, you lived by those rules of not talking about it in public.
Mm. Mm. So that was good. I took a few points from that article. One was that Tony Abbott's power base is that far right of the party. And so, you know, even if he didn't want to, he would be having to, you know, bend to their wishes, because that's the ones who are keeping him in power.
Mm.
And the other one I thought was interesting he came up with was, there's less political involvement by the population generally. And
absolutely.
So if you've got a small number of really active people, they can have a level of influence far beyond their actual numbers. And we know with the, you know, evangelical Christians that they're super motivated and well organized, and basically he was arguing that they're wielding more power than they really should be because of lack of involvement by the general population. And he was sort of indicating that the Labor Party is a little bit sheltered from that because of the machine that's in place that doesn't allow those small groups to have as much influence. So I thought that was an interesting sort of take on it as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting, because they are, the architecture of the two parties are different. Listeners, I was, before we came onto the record, I was talking about an address that was given by David Marr. He made the point that the union movement is exerting extraordinary influence over the ALP. So to a lesser extent, the Labor Party is being pushed around by the unions rather than the rank and file, in the same way the Christians are pushing the Liberals around rather than the rank and file. Anyway, but it was, yeah, thoroughly recommend it. It's a cracking good read. Make sure you go on and have a look at it.
Yep. So yeah. So that's
a little depressing in place, isn't it?
Yes. But well, speaking of depressing, or just speaking of just
bizarre,
just plain bizarre, is this whole border force operation down in Melbourne and what's going on there? So.
You give the timeline. It's just absurd, isn't it?
Well, you know, a press release comes out from the Australian Border Force saying officers will be positioned at various locations around the CBD, speaking with any individual we cross paths with, Mr. Smith said. You need to be aware of the conditions of your visa. If you commit visa fraud, you should know it's only a matter of time before you're caught out. So that's the press release. And when you combine those words with the you know, the Gestapo uniforms that these guys are running around in.
Black uniforms, it's not, paramilitary training, asking people for their papers. Where has our species seen that before?
It's not hard to make a connection with Nazi Germany. Like, you're really, where are your papers?
Yeah. But, okay, I'll cast aside my personal civil liberties objection to having the police walking around asking people for their papers. What idiot would think that would be a good idea to tell the public, yeah, we're going to walk around asking people for their papers? Did they not, you know, I mean, the first thing I first heard the report Friday afternoon when I was on my way home, and I thought to myself, these people have been smoking wacky tobacco. No one would actually do something like that. But no, lo and behold, by the time I got home, I was able to read into it. Not only had they done it, they'd publicised it.
Mm. Yep. So
crazy.
You know, of course they come out and say, oh, well, it was, you know, issued by somebody at the lower levels of the organisation, so that wasn't right. And it turns out it was actually, you know, issued on behalf of the Victorian and Tasmanian regional chief of the group, so that's...
And one would assume that he would have approved what was being said in his name, you would have thought.
Exactly. And then, you know, they come out and say, oh, it was a bit of clumsy wording. But it's not like... There's nothing clumsy about it. Like, what? They issued the press release and then a few hours later said, oh, we're not going to do anything at all now. Like, where was the hazy line? Like, there wasn't anything clumsy in the wording of it. It was very clear what they were intending to do.
Absolutely. And when you look at that timeline, the original thing saying that the police would be... would be out targeting crime in Melbourne for Melbourne CBD Friday and Saturday night. That's what you expected the civilian police force to do.
Yep.
But then when the Australian Border Force got involved, you think to yourself, well, what are they actually going to add to the whole thing?
Yes.
Surely if there's an issue with visas or something like that, I mean, the Jacks are going to pull someone up, and if they think there's an issue with visas, they might actually then contact the Border Force and say, look, we think we might have an overstay. Do you want to come and see him?
Yeah.
But... to have them out on the street in patrol, that's, you know, anyone, it's where we'd woken up in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was madness.
Yeah. You know, that it also, again, is reminiscent of the Tea Party, because in certain states in America, they've been doing racial profiling where they basically, if you look Hispanic, then you'll be asked for your papers and potentially deported. So this sort of racial profiling, that's the only way they could possibly have been thinking of conducting the operation, was to check out who doesn't look like a white Anglo-Saxon, and we'll check them out. I mean, that's nasty.
Yeah, we're really nasty. I mean, because there's a Guardian article that you've pointed us to, and it's, we'll put it gently there, a little more blunt. But I think they quote Julian Burnside in there, don't they? Where he actually brought the whole point up. He made the whole point about it. It'd have to be racial profiling.
Yeah, I might have stolen it from him, so I've read that many articles about it. It could have been from him, yeah.
Well, I thought Burnside was quoted. I was trying to find it. Sorry, listeners. Yeah. Anyway.
That's all right. But the other things to take out of all this is that initially Bill Shorten basically was in favour of it. And he said, well, according to The Australian, there was an exchange between a journalist and Bill Shorten. And the journalist said, "Australian Border Force officers are joining other agencies to target crime in Melbourne. Does Labor agree with this use of the Border Force?" And Shorten replied, "Labor obviously believes in targeting crime. I do hope that any of these actions are done to try and protect Australian laws, to make sure that people are not overstaying their visas, to make sure that temporary guest workers are not being exploited. Labor said, for a while we're concerned that under this government, our employment visas of temporary workers are becoming too slackly regulated." So that was his initial response. And of course, a few hours later, after the demonstration and after the uproar and all the rest of it, then he says, this is Shorten, "One of the most catastrophically silly ideas I've seen this government do. To be honest, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I'm sure, by the way, that regardless of one's politics, When you first heard about this, you would have gone, what? Blah, blah, blah." Like, the tone of those two missives from Bill Shorten are so completely different. And so, you know, he's no better.
My better half had a slightly different take on that. He asked me, "Do you think Bill Shorten is as spineless as a jellyfish or just occasionally?" And, you know, he's shown absolutely no morality at all. I mean, for starters, he's pushing his latest thing about, oh, you know, you read between the lines about temporary workers and that sort of stuff. It's these immigrants are coming to take your job. And then when he finds out that it is actually, you know, what I don't understand, I'm sorry, I'm the one speaking clumsily now. What I don't understand is, my initial reaction was, this is the police state going around demanding to see your papers. Why did his initial reaction, why was it nowhere near that? Or am I completely out of step? You know, it's just, I can't imagine anyone that was hoping to be Prime Minister or is currently Prime Minister would think anything other than this is a disgusting abuse of government power.
Well, it's because the current crop of politicians have no sense of purpose, and they're just there for power for power's
decency.
Sake, and got to be told by a poll as to what to think. So one final point from all this was, you know, if you genuinely want to catch people, why would you send out a notice in the media?
You wouldn't advertise it,
to advertise what you're going to be doing. Like, that would simply, you know, if you were a person with a dodgy visa, you just wouldn't go into the CBD of Melbourne on those days because you've been forewarned. Like, this, you know, even if you ignore the fact that it's reprehensible
wrong
conduct, just as a matter of efficiency, why would you do it? And of course, operational matters are, you know, normally so secret, and this one wasn't. But you just ask yourself, if they're getting these sorts of things wrong, then what else are they getting wrong that we don't even know about? So, terrible.
Listeners, it is. Listeners may well remember Tony Windsor, who was one of the independents that helped shore up Julia Gillard's numbers when she formed a minority government. And we also talked about him, I think, in episode 2 or 3 when there was a decision about the Shenhua coal mine. Windsor had an even more... I've lost for words, but his view of it was a little more Machiavellian, in that he feels that all of this is part of the way of the Labor, of the Abbott government keeping the population fearful. Yeah. And he's right. I'm frightened. I'm frightened by what else the government is actually up to.
Yeah.
Now, Scott, I'm not actually a frightened citizen, but I'm frightened of our government.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Now, you know, if there's a secular angle to any story, I'll take it. And
yep.
I've managed to find a secular angle to this one, Scott. And
in this one, yeah?
Yeah. I'm just going to play you a little thing here, and then you'll see the secular angle. Just hold on a moment.
May God bless you. May God bless your work. May God bless the country you are helping to protect and prosper.
So, Scott, that was Tony Abbott when he was commissioning all of the officers for the Australian Border Force and summoned all of the blessings that he possibly could. And I don't think they worked.
No. See, listeners, I'm old enough to remember a movie, God knows how old it is, called The Blues Brothers.
Right.
And in that, there's a line where the fat bloke says, "We're here, we're on a mission from God."
Yeah.
And clearly, the Border Force is on a mission from God.
Well, If they are, it's a strange mission, isn't it?
So it's a strange mission, yeah.
So anyway, all those blessings from Tony Abbott and nothing, you know, they certainly didn't help. They've got into a lot of trouble, so...
An awful lot of trouble. And it was funny how the usual Abbott cheer squad said, "Oh, this is all Twitter's fault."
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, all Twitter is... I'm not a big fan of social media myself either, but having said that, what it has done is it's given ordinary people people outside of the media a voice, in that everyone can now get a megaphone.
Yep.
And when enough people get their megaphones out, well, you know, that protest, I think there were 300 people turned up with barely a couple of hours' notice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know why? Because they're angry. And it was just a stupid thing to do, to start the whole thing and then to turn around and say, "Oh, this is the, you know, the latte left of Melbourne's cafe scene. They all got themselves upset." No, it's just a violation of principles that you just don't do in a liberal democracy. And so it's no wonder people were angry. So, no, I don't blame Twitter. It was a stupid decision by a government, that's all.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Last thing I'll say on it, but it did really make me very angry on Friday.
Yep. Just briefly, we mentioned last week that, Australia potentially bombing Syria, and clearly, you know, the Abbott government has said to the US government, "Please invite us to bomb Syria with you." And supposedly we're now considering that request. And got a few articles on the website in relation to that. Basically saying that is a crazy idea, that the situation with ISIS in Syria is that they're there and without a ground force in there to pull them out, they're there for good. And, you know, you can talk about bombings, but they're in there with the population. So unless you're going to be bombing the cities where all these, you know, innocent civilians are, then bombing's not going to do the trick. So it'll halt their progress as they're moving along one road to take over another city. But essentially, they're there for good now. And, the notion that we should get involved in that fight is just evil. And I found a quote by Tony Abbott where he said, "While there is a little difference between the legalities of airstrikes on either side of the border, there is no difference in the morality. Whether it's operating in Iraq or Syria, it is an absolutely evil movement. And in the end, when they don't respect the border, the question is, why should we?" Well, the answer is, Tony, because we're supposed to be law-abiding nation amongst other nations?
Well, that was exactly the answer I had. It was we're a law-abiding, decent nation. We are talking about a terrorist organisation, a gang of criminals.
Yep.
Of course they're not going to respect a border.
Yep.
But we're expected to because it's the right thing to do, and it's what you do as a nation state.
Yep.
But it's there. Surely, at some point, the West, John Kerry, David Cameron, Obama, Hollande, Abbott, all the rest of it, we're going to have to eventually pick up the phone and talk to Assad and actually say to him, "Well, you're probably the best of a bad lot."
Yep.
You know, it's the horse is bolted. You can't use a military solution against this anymore. It's fragmented to buggery now. I mean,
It's fragmented. It was always fragmented in the sense of the cultural differences between the various sects and between the Shia and the Sunni and the Kurds. And the only solution is to redraw some maps and let those sects have their own areas and get the hell out of there.
Well, I don't think we're going to add anything to it. I mean, like, it's made a point in one of the conversation articles. I think it's the one, Why the Fight Against the Islamic State is Not the Success We're Told It Is. There's a point in there where there is no sign of a truly stable government that can deal with the rampant corruption and the Sunni minority's suspicion of a Shia-led system. That's talking about Iraq. So, and he's right, because I think you made the point last week that the Sunni Iraqi army is not going in. Sorry, it's the other way around. The Shia Iraqi army is not going in and risking their lives for Sunni territory.
Yep.
So until, and that's just Iraq, that's before you even get into Syria, and I don't think either of us understand really the different factions that are operating there. But until the Iraqis can get themselves to understand that whether you're Sunni or whether you're Shia, you're Iraqi, then there's going to be no point us getting involved, because it's a sectarian civil war between religious sects, and there's no way an outside party can fix that. It's got to be fixed by the combatants themselves.
Yep, yep.
They're going to have to come to their own peace. And, you know, I've got to say that Ms. Bishop, our foreign minister, she's gone way down in my estimation in the last couple of weeks, but this sort of suggesting that the European migration problem is because the Europeans aren't dropping enough ordnance on Syria. That's
yes.
I mean, okay, yeah. So we take the Australian logic of saying, well, we've got to stop the boats so that these people don't drown at sea. Then we'll take Ms. Bishop's logic and apply that over to Europe and say, well, if we drop more explosives on the people, they're going to stay put rather than try and cross the Mediterranean to get to Europe. Now, Fist, what would you do if explosives were falling from the sky? Would you run or would you stay put?
I'd be trying to get the hell out of there if I could.
Exactly. So I didn't understand her. I was looking for her logic, but I just can't see it. But anyway,
yep.
It's got to be solved politically without explosives.
Yeah. So that's Syria, and I'm really worried that over the next week or so, the Abbott government is going to just come out and say, well, we've been asked by the Americans and we're going to start bombing Syria. And there we go. Australia's just further, you know, entrenched in madness. But
the next step is then, you know, like it's been pointed out, you need boots on the ground to do it. Eventually they're going to have to start saying, you know, you can't just continually have airstrikes to contain a problem. Eventually there'll be pressure to put Western boots on the ground, and then that means we're going to get dragged into a civil war, and that's not going to end well for anyone.
Yep. And meanwhile, you've been dropping bombs, creating civilian casualties, and guess what? You know, they won't
hate you for
it. As your partner says. So that's Syria, and we'll see what develops in the next week or two. But it's potentially
not looking
all
pretty.
Bad news there. So, moving on, one thing we've also said in the past was, in relation to gay marriage, was, you know, this sort of fobbing off of the decision to the public, and, you know, it's clearly the right decision to stop discrimination against one group, and that's not, you know, fundamentally right issues are not things that you have to, you know, go to the public about. You just do them because they're right. And I found an interesting article from The Conversation, and basically it was referring to the Menzies era when they introduced no-fault divorce. And
I thought it was the Uniform Divorce Laws. I didn't think forgive me if I'm wrong, but I thought no-fault divorce laws didn't come until the 70s. But this was Uniform Commonwealth Divorce Laws.
I think you're correct. Right. Let me see here. In many ways, the adoption of a uniform law of divorce in Australia was the 1950s equivalent of today's debates about same-sex marriage. The major churches in Australia opposed Barwick's divorce bill, especially its embrace of a no-fault provision.
Okay, well, I was wrong then.
In condoning divorce, said the Catholic Church spokesman for Victoria, the state is simply sabotaging itself. And again, the Catholic Church spokesman said, no true Christian would obtain divorce with a view to remarriage, and no true Christian would keep company with a divorcee or marry one. So maybe the no-fault bit didn't get through the final legislation. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I just had it in my head that the no-fault divorce came around.
Yeah, you're right. The 1975 Family Law Act.
Whitlam, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it might be that that particular part didn't come through at that time. But the point of it is that basically Menzies stared down this clerical opposition and theological / feriological, because if we say theologian, we have to say
feriologist. We've got to say feriologist.
So he basically, you know, passed the act. He didn't go for a plebiscite. And at that time in those days, it's very arguable that it's the same sort of change in culture to what there was previously, but at least he made a decision that he thought was right and didn't have to rush off to the people for a plebiscite on such a matter, unlike our current leader.
Well, exactly. But also I think that the other big difference too is that the Liberal Party back then was a genuine Liberal Party.
Mm.
I mean, we don't have a Liberal Party anymore. We have a Conservative Party.
Yeah.
And that, I think, was the big difference. And, you know, I mean, sure, people of the left would always poo-hoo Menzies and say what a stick in the mud he was, but when you compare him to this current crop, he was a bloody saint.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, you're a big supporter of the Republic.
I am a supporter of the Republic, yes.
What's happening in that corner of the world?
It's been given a boost, that's for sure. Peter Fitzsimmons, who's known as he's a columnist, I believe, for the Fairfax Group, isn't he?
Mm.
Anyway, whoever it is, he's a well-known journalist. He's taken over the, not the day-to-day running of it, but he's the chairman of the board. And he certainly reinvigorated it and tried to put some, trying to get the whole thing back on the national agenda. Certainly it is still split along a party lines, for sure. I mean, Shorten has said that he would like an Australian head of state. I think he's got a timeline of 5 years, or maybe the votes have got to be held by 2020. The Republican movement has decided on a different tactic this time from when they attempted in 1998. What they want to do this time is have a non-binding vote, or plebiscite, which will simply determine whether or not there is enough support for becoming a republic, and then after that you've got then discussions about what type of model.
Right.
That's where I fear the wheels will fall off, because there are people like me, for example, who favour a directly elected president, and then there are others who don't want a directly elected president but do want a Bill of Rights, and then there's others who don't want to touch a Bill of Rights. And, you know, a republic is not just a republic. There are different matters that have to be considered. But having said that, though...
But all those people you've just mentioned might all be in the category of don't want a monarchy anymore, so they would...
Absolutely, the first hurdle will jump. Yeah. I have no doubt whatsoever that first hurdle of saying, do you want a republic, there'll be a resounding yes.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's silly down here at the other end of the planet. You know, we haven't even got our own monarchy. We borrow someone else's.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have I must look that up before the next podcast, before we next talk about the republic, about what the percentage is of people that have got an Anglo-Celtic lineage versus something else. You know, it's no longer... even if you, I don't know, casting aside the whole ethnicity of people, it's just silly that you have a, in this day and age, that you have your head of state being a resident of another nation, and they've got the job based on their birth, accident at birth. It's madness. So, yes, I'm much bigger supporter of the Republic this time around than what I was back in the day, probably because I've left the Liberal Party behind, but will we get it through this time? Yes, first hurdle for sure. Second hurdle is going to be the bigger one. That's where we've got to then try and keep us all together with, and that'll be where it'll be like herding cats. Yeah. You were about to say something, sorry.
No. I was just simply, just along those same lines then, might come at some stage also the question of a flag, a new flag.
Yeah, and that's considering what our cousins across the ditch have done. Have a look at the new, they've narrowed the... They've narrowed the New Zealand design down to four possibilities, and they've been able to do it without having blood in the street.
I haven't seen them, but I've heard really positive reports, like silver fern type stuff, is it?
Yeah, I think the four of them have all do feature the silver fern, but surprisingly none of them are black and white.
Right.
They do have the blue and red, but the Union Jack has gone, and... Yeah, you know, if they can do it, like I said, if they can do it without blood in the street, surely we can do the same thing, one would have thought.
Yep. So, for you mad keen anti-religion people out there, the Union Jack, which I didn't realise until just the other day, when a guy on my squash team was telling me, that the Union Jack actually comprises the Red Cross of St. George, the White Saltire of St. Andrew for Scotland, and the Red Saltire or Saltire of St. Patrick to represent Ireland. So all those crosses in there are representing saints, for goodness sake. So
if you're... For a rabid secularist like yourself, that's just offensive.
Yep. Well, armed with that knowledge, I'm even, you know... I've become offended by that, where I wasn't before. So... So, yeah, the crosses in the middle relate to saints. Well,
these symbols, you know, when the discussion does move to the flag fist, you'll hear people such as Alan Jones and all the rest of it that'll be talking about what an affront it is to the memory of Anzac and that sort of stuff. Just, listeners, read your history, but it was in the 50s that the Menzies government took the current flag out of being sort of the then equivalent of the boxing kangaroo and made it the Australian flag.
Right.
When the men charged the beaches at Anzac Cove, the flag they were carrying was the Union Jack. They were part of the Imperial Forces. Yeah. They didn't even have the blue ensign with them. My understanding is, and I've still got to get this verified, but my understanding was the first time we had our own flag in battle, well, for want of a better term, was as part of our United Nations effort in the Korean conflict. Even during the Second World War, most of our encampments had the Union Jack above them, not the current flag. So when they start the whole, oh, but what about the diggers, what about the vets and all that sort of stuff, no, it's nonsense. You know, we can change our flag without worrying.
Yeah.
Without offending the souls of the dead.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath waiting, though. So
no, not under this current government, no.
So Scott, I also came across, I think this came through the Facebook page, Karen had posted something along these lines, and this was a recording of a sermon where they were doing, on the Sunshine Coast at Noosa, the Anglican Church of Noosa, was doing commissioning of chaplains and religious instruction teachers. So I'm going to play a little snippet of this sermon from the Reverend Mark Calder, and he's addressing these groups in sort of two distinct fashions. You've got the religious instruction teachers, who are the ones who can go in for an hour into a government school and Bible bash the kids, and then you've got the Scripture Union chaplains who are present on the school grounds but have to be more circumspect about their proselytising and have to hold back a bit on what they say. So I'll play you a little bit of this sermon, and it brings back dark memories for me of having listened to a lot of sermons in my time, and I'll feel a bit of a shiver down my spine as we listen to this, but here it is.
I mean, surely we want people who are witty and clever and self-assured, who have all the answers and are wise and persuasive and entertaining and engaging. Well, no. No, what we want is people who will speak about Jesus and the fact that he died on the cross and rose again so that we can be forgiven and have eternal life. Teachers, the evil one will whisper in your ear all the time, you're not up for this. Sort of what Trish was saying earlier. You're not clever enough. You don't have all the answers. Who do you think you're kidding? You're not creative. You're not interesting. And you'll often head to class in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. Good. Because then you'll turn to God and you will not depend on your own cleverness. You'll ask for help and you'll speak about Jesus. What do we want our kids to learn? Not how to be nice boys and girls. Not how to achieve in the world. Not how to get on with their friends. We want them to know Jesus. We want them to know him, to love him, to trust him, to go on to serve him. We want them to know that there is no other way but Jesus. We want them to know that being Christian is not about being religious, but it's about being in a relationship. We want them to know that they cannot get right with God on their own efforts, but only through what Christ has done on the cross. Yes, we want them to know Jesus Christ and him crucified. 5 words for you to take home this afternoon, which will guard and guide you, which will sustain and inspire your ministry, which will shape your ministry: Jesus Christ and him crucified. SU chaplains, I have 5 words for you this afternoon too. 5 words from our second reading from 1 Peter. Here they are. Prepared to give an answer. Prepared to give an answer. Your job is different. Sadly, tragically, because we are no longer in a Christian nation but in a secular state, you face limitations in what you can proactively say. And in the course of your ministry, you will suffer for doing what is right. There are forces at work to detract and to distract. Another High Court challenge this year about your very validity to be in our schools. And yet, friends, we know that God is bigger than all of that. Nothing can stop his purposes.
Well, let's hope something can stop him.
Well, you know, when he said, sadly, tragically, because we're no longer in a Christian nation, we live in a secular state, I was thinking to myself, well, mercifully, we live in a secular state. But,
yeah, but not secular enough.
Not secular enough that these idiots are allowed to go into publicly funded schools. Did you notice the number of times he referred to these people as having a ministry?
Yes, I did.
Now, this belies that, you know, the usual nonsense of supporters of the National School Chaplaincy Program is that they're there for the kids. They're there to help them out, just to be a helping hand, to be a sensitive listening ear and all that sort of stuff. This 9 minutes and 4 seconds of nonsense on the internet, which I'm surprised they haven't taken down by now, because it just shows exactly what the whole program's about, is that this is not anything to do with the kids other than converting them into customers of their tax-free business of selling afterlife insurance. It's got nothing to do with their welfare. I mean, even when you go back to the RI stuff, which is where the little kids get their minds poisoned, where was it here? What do we want our kids to learn? Not how to be nice boys and girls, not how to achieve in the world. I mean,
And not how to get on with your friends, but rather how to have a relationship with Jesus, which you can't do on your own. You know, you need Jesus.
You can't do anything on your... You can't reform yourself on your own. I didn't write that one down, but I remember the time my ears pricked up when I first listened to it, and I thought, it's just this... They're reinforcing this dogma of original sin, that you're broken and, you know, you've got the problem, we've got the solution.
Yes.
It's a very slick business model that the church has got.
It is, and... In his second part, where he's talking to the chaplains and he's basically saying, you've got to be careful and you've got to comply with the rules. And he said, what I want you to do is just to be, you know, perfect Christians and be amazing people and be happy and loving. And then when people ask you, how come you're like this? Then his message was, be prepared to give an answer. And then that answer was going to be, well, because I'm Christian and I have a relationship with God. So that was his sort of message to them was, well, you can't go out there sort of initiating stuff, but be one hell of a great person. And when somebody asks you, how come you're so happy? Then you can say, because, you know, Jesus and blah, blah, blah. So
you'd almost prefer it if they would actually... You know, having once been a teenage bloke myself, I reckon if someone had come in there waving a Bible in front of me saying, look at me, I'm a Christian, you'd be more inclined to get turned off, I would have thought, rather than... Anyway, but this sort of very devious, wasn't it? It was a clandestine sort of way of getting into the kids and saying, well, you know, why are you so happy, Chappy? Well... Because I'm walking in the warm light of Jesus. I mean,
and when people say these people are harmless and just let them do it and what's the problem with it, well, you've only got to listen to that sort of stuff and go, oh, geez, hang on a minute. There really are that kind, you know. This isn't the softly, you know, gentle approach that you get from... that you think you might get. It's hardcore Bible bashing.
Yeah. And this is from the Anglican Church, too. Hmm. This isn't from Hillsong.
No.
You know, this is not...
You'd expect better from the Anglican Church.
Well, you would have thought so. Hmm. You know, you'd think that you'd get a calmer, more rational approach from either Catholic or Anglican Church, but this is... The way he was carrying on, you were almost expecting him to break out into song.
Hmm.
You know?
Yep.
You know, I listened to it and I was really quite disturbed.
Yep. So
So anyone that says that it's just all about the kids and that they're not doing any harm, no, they are harm.
Yeah.
It's not all about the kids. It's like I very cynically said, they are there to recruit more customers for their tax-free business of selling afterlife insurance.
Absolutely. That's what they're about.
And here's the sting in the tail for that, listeners. Tomorrow, while you're at work, the Commonwealth Government, via special purpose grants to the states... Mm-hmm. are going to spend $260,000 of your money on that nonsense. Mm.
Yep. It's outrageous. So,
it is outrageous. So, I know I'll get in trouble from you for depressing people, but...
That's okay. We just won't finish on that note. But in late breaking news, Scott...
In late breaking news. I've not seen tonight's news, so...
Pope Francis... has come out and said some things about abortion.
Really?
Yes, and this is believed to be in sort of preparation for his visit to the United States of America in about 3 weeks or so. And he's basically instructing the priests to accept... confessions from women who have had abortions, provided they are truly contrite about what they've done. And this is seen as a good thing. This is progress. So provided they've the forgiveness of God cannot be denied to one who has repented, especially when that person approaches the sacrament of confession with a sincere heart in order to obtain reconciliation with the Father. So you can have forgiveness for your abortion, provided you're really, really sorry about it.
So the fact that a woman has not done anything illegal, but actually obtained a legally provided service performed by a medically competent professional rather than the horrors of the whole backyard abortion industry in the 60s. That's still, you know, provided she agrees that what she did was wrong, then she can then confess her sins to a priest.
That's right. You can add that to the confessional list now. And that's seen as a progressive move, Scott. That's the...
Well, how about letting them take the pill in the first place so that, you know, so that the faithful don't have unwanted pregnancies?
Yes.
And, you know, on top of all of that, like, we've got an American in our office who was talking about, you know, where you have the big problems with teenage pregnancies in the States, mm-hmm. in those parts of America which is controlled by the Bible bashers who won't allow sex education in schools. So you have a general level of ignorance amongst boys and girls that should know better about how where babies come from, and they end up, surprise, surprise, pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But at least now they can, if they get an abortion...
Now they can confess
and
their sins.
And they're really sorry, then they can confess. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose it's progress. I mean, once upon a time, the Pope used to burn people at the stake, so...
Yes.
It's all up from there,
yep.
isn't it?
So, another test for you, Scott. Essential report. This time I didn't even email it to you.
I failed the last one, so let's see how
we
go.
It was really interesting, the last one. This one...
It was, and it really surprised me, I must admit. Yes.
So last time, two-party preferred was Labor leading 51-49. What do you think it is this week?
Wouldn't have thought it would be changed all that much. I mean, there might be a slight improvement for Labor.
Yep.
So maybe 52-48.
Oh, Scott. Smack on, very good. So
I haven't read it.
No, you haven't. So the other one that they've got here is that which party would you trust most to handle the following issues? And management of the economy and overall, still, you know, the coalition gets 40%. Labor 24%. Greens 5% and Don't Know's 31%. Like, this notion that the Liberal Party are the better managers of the economy.
Look, I have a little theory, so it's backed up by no research or anything like mm-hmm. that. But have you noticed that the news, when it talks about the economy, they always seem to run to the budget bottom line?
Right.
Now, I am a nerd. I do love economics and that sort of stuff. But I learned when I was at university that economic management, there were several parts of it, and one of them was fiscal management. Fiscal meaning the federal budget. So somewhere along the lines, the Liberal Party machine has managed to make people think that the economy is the budget.
Mm-hmm.
The budget, the federal budget, is part of the economy, not the whole
yes.
thing. So yes, it's true, Labor very rarely delivers government surpluses. It's a matter of public record. It's easily found, it's not disputed. But you've got to say that when you were faced with a set of numbers that Wayne Swan was faced with at the outbreak of the global financial crisis, it would have been irresponsible for governments not to loosen the purse strings to try and prop up private sector demand. So the whole question of economic management, I think, is one that's largely misunderstood by the electorate.
I think that's right.
So hence, I think that's why the Liberals score higher.
Mind you, now, because I would have to check, though. I'd be, sometime between now and the next podcast, let's look at budgets delivered by Conservative versus Labor governments and whether they are in surplus or not. I thought there was an interesting statistic where the Conservatives' record really wasn't that flash, but I'm not 100% on that.
Okay, look, certainly the Fraser's government wasn't brilliant at running surplus budgets. They ran deficit budgets, fairly sizable ones
yep.
too. The coalition under Howard and Costello, it was impossible for them
yeah.
not to deliver surplus budgets.
Yep.
I mean, like, it was runaway positive terms of trade. You know, apparently they were constantly getting updates from Treasury, and they're always on the upside.
Yeah.
So, you know, Donald Duck could have delivered a surplus budget under those economic conditions.
Yep. Yep. Okay, one more question on this essential report, which ties in what we've been talking about with this whole Tea Party scenario with the coalition. And it says, do you think the following parties are too right-wing conservative or too left-wing progressive or about right? And in relation to the Liberal Party, 34% thought that they were too right-wing or conservative, and only 7% thought that they were too left-wing slash progressive. So I think people are catching on. Mind you, 26% said about right and 33% said don't know. But there's still that's a significant margin of people who are going, you know what, this Liberal Party is too right-wing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I forget the name of the journalist today who was making the point that, you know, he said something like, I hoped that Tony Abbott would be an interesting Conservative Prime Minister. Mm. But he says, he's not interesting, he's just a Conservative Prime Minister. And, you know, it's true. I think you made the point earlier on that it's becoming very much like the American Tea Party. I don't think if Menzies were alive today that I'd be surprised if he would vote Liberal, to be honest.
Yep. So, so Scott, that's our issues. And folks, I'm away on holidays for a few weeks, so there'll be a bit of a break in publication of our podcast, but we'll come back in about 3 or 4 weeks' time with a whole bunch of stuff. So while you won't hear from us for a while, fear not, we're still going. It's just that I'm on holidays and we'll catch up with everybody.
We've not been kidnapped by a militant wing of the Australian Christian
Lobby. Yes, and what we will do on return, one of our listeners mentioned on Facebook wanting to examine the 1981 High Court case that looked at Section 116 of the Constitution. So we'll be doing that. And
We will be doing that one, but I'm sorry, I'm not the lawyer, so I didn't understand it properly. I'll be able to use these couple of weeks while the Fist is on holidays to get myself brushed up
just
on it.
Just briefly, it's really interesting that the American First Amendment states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, that wording in the Constitution in America is enough to stop government funding, is enough to stop government funding of religious schools and to stop any religion in public schools. So, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Now, our Section 116 is really close to that. The Commonwealth shall not make any law for establishing any religion, or for imposing any religious observance, or for prohibiting the free exercise of any religion, and no religious test shall be required for any office or public trust under the Commonwealth. The wording is unbelievably close.
It's almost identical.
And in America, that was read as being enough to stop any form of religion in public schools. Yet here in Australia, we've got the government throwing money at private schools. And that was the 1981 decision, which we can talk about more in depth. One of the leading decision makers in that was Sir Garfield Barwick, was the Garfield Barwick address that Dyson Hayden was going to give. And a few other characters were involved in that decision. Lionel Murphy, who was a former Attorney General under the Hawke government, and a noted left-winger who was often the lone dissenting voice in a lot of things. So that is an interesting one. And we really need to talk about, down the track, some sort of referendum would be great to really shore up 116 and really get religion out of, to be banned because of the Constitution. And then it would
clarify, not banned completely, but banned from the government space.
Yes, a truly secular way. So,
exactly.
So,
I will read up. I'll read up on this case for sure, so that by the time you get back, I'll be an expert.
There you go. All right, folks. Well, that will do us for this week. We will see you in a few weeks' time, and take care until then.
And thank you very much for listening, everyone. And we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.